This is Deanna Spingola. It is Wednesday, October 9th, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Andrew S. McGregor. He is a retired police officer from Victoria, South Australia, and is an expert in analyzing false flag massacres. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. It's morning there. Yes, it's the next day. It's October 10th.
In Australia.
Pardon me?
It's 8 a.m. On the east coast of Australia.
Amazing. Okay, so you're 14 hours ahead of us. So you have been writing some very interesting things, particularly an article that you did about Jim Stone. Now, Jim Stone has been around for some time, has produced some interesting articles. He writes for the Rebel
in Oz, Andrew Winkler.
Yes. The Rebel. And did some articles, and there's another gentleman by the name of James Fairgain. And
I never wrote about James Fairgain.
Okay.
I've done a reply piece for him, but the original article, I called it Joe Viles and the Mouse That Roared.
Yes.
It was tracing the history of Joe Viles right up to Jim Stone.
Exactly. So tell us about what you found.
Well, I was extremely lucky. I managed to purchase a book called Open Verdict that was written by Tony Collins in about 1990 in England. And it was about the murder of 25 scientists over there. And there's another three survived their accidents. It's a very amazing book. It follows an article that Tony Collins wrote that was printed in the Computer Weekly on the 5th of March 1987. And when you read the book, and then you come to the epilogue, the murders go on right up until I think about 1988, I think. Hang on a minute, I'll check that to make certain. September 88 was the 24th. Murders were going right up until September 1988. But the epilogue of the book was all about Joe Viles.
Now, give us a little background about Joe Viles. Talked about him before, but just give us just a teeny bit of background.
Right. Joe Viles is a hitman. He's worked for various governments. He's been assassinating people since, once you read Open Verdict, since 1973, getting people out of the way. In Australia, Joe ran the Port Arthur massacre that occurred in Tasmania on the 28th of April 1996. And once we established in 2004 that he was meeting with two other people on the balcony of the Broad Arrow Cafe at the Port Arthur incident about 15 minutes after the massacre. He met with a constable, Justin Noble, and Hans Overbeek. And once we realised that, we then realised that the only person who could have been running the Port Arthur massacre was Joe Viles. Then later on in 2004, I was able to identify that Joe Viles was also Ari Ben-Menashe. Now, most Americans know Ari Ben-Menashe for his book, Prophets of War. And his major statement that would affect the Americans was that he actually witnessed George W. Bush, then head of the CIA, meeting in Paris with the Iranians in regard to the American
Iran. Okay, that's the guy. All righty.
Right, so you have a look at that little bit of information, and one of the things you start realizing, I think it was Seymour Hersh. Ari then went on to help him to write his book on the Samson option, we're told. But Seymour Hersh suddenly realized that Ari Ben-Menashe was full of lies. His information wasn't correct. And there was a major scream about that. There was another journalist, Craig Unger, who made some lovely statement. He said, you listen to Joe. You know, he puts all the journalists through his story, tells them all the little bits, and it becomes extremely excited, and you believe him. You print his articles verbatim, and then you watch your career go up in flames. Liars and cheats are not very good things to base your a journalist's career on, unless, of course, you're working for the government.
Yes, and it's okay to lie and cheat and steal and all those other things.
Yes. So, Craig Unger's, apparently, his career suffered a major hit by believing in Ari Ben-Menashe, who I demonstrate is Joe Viles. But Joe Viles goes right back. This book, Open Verdict, talks about the various suicides or accidents that various scientists have. And it goes back into the Star Wars period of Ronald Reagan, and apparently the English were at the forefront with their work on computers. And I think it was Stephen Askell who wrote the foreword on Open Verdict, stating, you know, the English were at the front of these experiments and that in an electronic warfare. And he called it a war, you know. But once you have a look at the book, you know, murder has always been a crime. Even in war, murder is still a crime. You can kill a man at the front of a thing in proper battle, but to murder a person has always been totally illegal. So that was getting very interesting, but again, the story, Joe Viles comes in. He came in. The article was printed on the 5th of March. Tony Collins was interviewing Joe Viles at the end of, in March. And then on the 30th of March, there's a David Sands. His accidental death came up. And Joe said, remind me of what happened to me. And the really interesting thing is what happened to David Sands happened to another journalist in America earlier this year by the name of Michael Hastings.
Oh, yes.
Which Jim Stone wrote about.
Yes. That was a very interesting case, very interesting incident. And, of course, there's a lot of controversy about it, a lot of questions about it. Just some weird things.
And then when you start reading what Jim Stone has written about, you can see that Jim Stone has moved the goalposts. He's made some terrible, terrible statements. And any policeman who's been at the scene of a motor car accident, especially a fatal, would start recognising that things have gone wrong. And I explain that in the article I've written, The Mask That Roared. And this immediately pops up and says that Jim Stone's not doing us any favours. He's telling us lies. And so have you got the article, The Mask That Roared?
Yes.
So have you read it properly?
The Mask That Roared. I've got it right in front of me. Mm-hmm.
Good. Have you read it properly?
Properly?
Yes.
Have you
read the part I've done on Jim Stone about that particular accident?
Okay, let me just bring that part up here. Yes. Yes.
Right, now what you've got there, come on, mouse, I've got to get mine up. I've got an earlier article up at the moment I want to go through. What you've actually got there, and I pointed out quite clearly that you've got Michael Hastings driving down the street. It's a normal street. And all of a sudden, he's the motor of his Mercedes convertible. No, it wasn't. It was a coupe, Mercedes coupe.
Right.
Leaves his vehicle, and it ends up 200 yards in up ahead of from where the Mercedes ended up against the tree in the center medium strip.
Which is kind of interesting to me. I have had a Mercedes, and they are just incredible cars. I just cannot see a motor just flying out of a Mercedes. I mean, they're just built like a tank.
Yes, that actually means that the only way it could be separated would have been a bomb.
Yes.
So that, the vehicle hasn't struck anything. It's going down the road. What would the speed limit be in that particular area? What,
probably 30 or 35.
So it's not very fast, right?
Right, because it's it was a residential area.
Yes, and if I remember correctly, the first bit I saw, there was a gentleman with a little, what you call the Jewish cap on the back of his head.
A yarmulke.
With the hose.
A yarmulke.
Yes, so the gentleman wearing one of those is standing on the road. He's got his garden hose in hand, and he's got Buckley's hope of doing anything about it. You understand? So, and again, I keep on forgetting you drive on the wrong side of the road, but...
No, you
can't. Yeah, come on, you say the same thing about us. But here we have the car stuck in the... In the medium strip up against a tree. So, all right. We now have a look at you've got the Mercedes-Benz going down the street.
Right.
There is a major force applied to it. The motor takes off and it'll be a fair amount of heat. It goes through the front of the car, continues up the road for about 200 yards.
Yeah, which is amazing. That is amazing.
That's a bomb. There's absolutely no doubt about it. That's a bomb. But you see, for the bomb to take off and leave the vehicle, but you know, it's Newton's second law. Every force, you know, has an equal and opposite reaction. Well, for the force to push the motor up the road also pushes against the Mercedes-Benz.
Right.
You understand?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, traveling at 30 miles an hour sort of thing, you know, it could almost stop the vehicle. And the vehicle no longer has a motor, so therefore it's got no drive. All it's got is a little bit of
momentum.
Left in it. And you then get a camber of the road, so the car would just slowly wander off onto the medium strip, strike a little bit of the curb there sort of thing, mount that and come to rest against a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only damage to the tree would be by the fire. So, you know, the other thing that was extremely interesting was the amount of fire that was not only under the car, but it was also inside the car. Now, I think most Americans drive cars, and most Americans that have seen accidents or been involved in accidents. And look, when I was a young lad back in 1971, you know what a thing called a tram is?
Yes.
Right. Now, I saw a tram that collided with a truck, and it ripped the petrol tank, which was at the side of the truck, you know, the round barrel type thing, ripped that off the truck's thing. It got jammed underneath the driver's compartment of the tram. And the tram running on steel tracks, and when you break it, there's sparks occur, something the petrol ignited, and here was the poor tram driver trapped in his cabin, you know, with fire going all around him. He did survive, but he would have been terribly, terribly burnt. That is that, and a, I think it was a Morris Minor at a drive-in theatre, and that'll be back into 78. A minor struck a mini in the back, exiting a drive-in theatre. The mini went up in flames, and the person in the back seat couldn't get out, died. So they're the only two accidents I've ever been to, sort of thing, where there's been an accident with a car, and the car's gone up in flames. So you have a look at this Mercedes coupe. The motor's been blown out. Mercedes-Benz extremely safe cars. They don't burst in. They do not.
They don't. They don't. That's the reason I bought one, because now, the they were thing, safe.
The other thing, so most cars also have a, with their gas tank, have a system that if the fuel tank splits, that it's got a self-sealing thing on. So again, if the motor's pulled out, and the vehicle, the system would virtually turn off. I believe would virtually turn off the petrol, so it's not going to get much leakage. So it's not going, the petrol's not going to burn. So, you know, I'm having a look at this and thinking, petrol, the fuel tank also goes under the floor of the vehicles. It doesn't go through the cabin where all the passengers are.
Right.
So why is the passenger compartment of the Mercedes-Benz, that's where the driver and passenger sit, why is it burning so furiously? And the answer has to be is because there is an accelerant in there, something to burn.
Okay.
So really, that does mean that poor Michael Hastings was hit by a bomb. There's no brake skid marks or anything like that, because the brakes haven't been applied. It's been driving along, kaboom, goes an explosion. The motor takes out the front. Car loses most of its impetus and just rolls it into the centre medium strip.
Okay.
And it's a ball of flames. Again, you know, it has to be a bomb, and there has to be accelerant in there.
Sure.
And then Jim Stone then comes along and says, "Oh, you know, they've moved it. This is wrong, and that is wrong. It's nothing wrong. It's perfectly normal." But Jim is taking the focus away of the bomb, and of what's actually happened. And I even start wondering to myself: is it possible that Joe Viles or Jim Stone was the actual culprit, sort of thing, who put the bomb in Michael Hastings' car? Because Joe Viles has always been working for a government agency. In Australia, he was working with the Coalition for Gun Control that was run by George Soros. At the Port Arthur massacre, there were 7 ASIO operatives killed at that site. And there was... Well, if you count Dennis and Mary Olson, who were gun control, if you count them as spooks, there was 6 American spooks at the Port Arthur massacre. And I think there was about another 30. I counted 30 Australian intelligence operatives who would have been there at the site at the time. So... I also made the claim, too, that with the Dunblane massacre, that, you know, Joe Viles had to have been in charge of that. If you're in charge of one operation, I mean, and you've got a series of operations that have been, confirmed, but there's, I think it was there 5, was there 7, I think it was 7 massacres from 1987 until 1996 that the Coalition for Gun Control people wrote about. And what explained, and that again is in the article. So what you've actually got, if you've got a person in charge of one, the normal situation would be that he would have been in charge of all of them. If he was in charge of all of them, he would have been in charge of the massacre at Dunblane. And when you have a look at that massacre, where Thomas Hamilton committed suicide after shooting the teacher and the students, shooting them all with a Browning automatic. He then committed suicide by lying on the floor putting a Smith & Wesson revolver into his mouth and pulling the trigger twice.
I don't think so. Whoops.
Bloody telephone. 8:23 in the morning? My godfather. Anyway, so you know, the biggest problem I have over here is I've only got a few friends. We don't live close together. We can't sit around a conference table and bounce ideas off our head. We're not a think tank thing. So sometimes it takes us years, you know, for a certain idea to come out and, you know, be pushed around and try to understand exactly, you know, what has happened. We got to a certain stage and thought, oh, beauty, you know, that's marvellous. But we don't take it to the next conclusion. And that was something I've just recently been doing with Joe Viles. And it becomes very, that these people don't like it. But Joe Viles apparently died in on the 17th of July 2005. Just before he died, Stuart Beattie had written an unauthorised biography of Joe Viles called Did Joe Viles Ever Play Fullback for Jerusalem? And the answer is obviously no. You then, I put out an article, 2004, from it came from Shooters, the Shooters website, Shooters News website, that identified Joe Viles with Constable Justin Noble and Hans Overbeek on the balcony of the Broad Arrow Cafe. And then I told John Kaminsky that late 2004, I think it was, that, you know, it was my belief that Joe Viles was also Ali Benbenashi.
Oh, okay.
So for some unknown reason, Joe Viles died. The initial reports that we got said that he died of kidney failure, I think it was. Kidney failure, which is an extremely nasty way to die. But we're also told that his wife, Marilyn, was overseas at the time at another funeral and had to race back for her own husband's funeral. And I'm thinking,
how old was he when he died?
We don't know, but we would imagine he'd, you know, I've got no idea. There's very little information put out on Joe Viles. You don't know his date of birth. There's only ever been one photograph of him in Australia, and that was made by, was it Tony Ashby from the Western Australian?
Okay. Now he was in a room. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So there's still only been able to produce one photograph, and Stuart Beattie was the first to find that one. Now everybody uses the same photograph in the same article.
Ben Menashe was an Iranian-born Israeli businessman who was a...
No.
What was he?
That's his cover.
Okay, but that's what I'm saying. This is his cover, but in actuality, he was a security consultant and author and an employee of Israel's military intelligence director.
No, nothing to do with Israel.
Really?
Nothing to do with Israel. Why do you think Seymour Hersh got so upset and called him a fraud?
Okay.
Ali Benbenashi was always Joe Viles. Joe Viles is English.
Okay.
Ali Benbenashi was never. If you have a look at Ali Benbenashi in 2001, 2003, when he was working against the leader of the opposition working for Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. He was doing the work for the British Commonwealth.
Okay.
There were a lot of Australians, Canadians, and other people were extremely upset about the white farmers in Zimbabwe who were being murdered by Mugabe's men.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted Mugabe out. You know, he was killing people. at least his men were. And Ari Benbenassi goes over there with Alexander, Henry Legault, sort of thing, and they set up the opposition leader just prior to the elections. The opposition leader is arrested. He's on trial. Mugabe wins the election, and it was all initiated a fortnight before the meetings of which we call CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That immediately took all the pressure off the Canadian and the Australian and the British prime ministers in regard to the ongoing murders that were taking place in Zimbabwe. So the Israelis, you know, don't control Great Britain, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Zimbabwe, and all the other members of the British Commonwealth. So you look at that thing. Ari Benbenassi per se was working for the British Commonwealth, working for, be it MI5, MI6, ASIO, the Canadian Secret Intelligence Service, or the Australian Secret Intelligence, or whatever. And then when you go over and you have a look at the trial, and was it George, what was his name, the South African bloke who represented Mandela in his trials. He blew Ari Benbenassi out of the water. He made Ari Benbenassi look an absolute idiot. And Ari was up in the box, I think, for about 2 months. And
now, didn't somebody bomb his house in Canada, in Montreal?
Yes, we're told that. We are told that.
Okay.
His house apparently burnt down on the 4th of December last year, 2012.
Right.
You then go back and you have a look at the so-called, apparently you go to the videotapes of that took place in Canada, in Montreal, on the 4th of December, 2001. And Ari Benbenassi, you know, the secretary walks in with his birthday cake. I am 50 years of age. You are having a major meeting with a major client, and you stop to have a birthday celebration with a birthday cake? Oh, my God, Father. Anyway, so you have a look at that bombing last year, so in Montreal, and you know, the one thing that Robert Parry and Brian Hutchinson didn't state, you know, Ari forgot his 61st birthday. It was his... Ari Benbenassi's 61st birthday,
right,
on the 4th of December, and his house has just been burnt down.
Right.
What a lovely birthday present. You understand?
Yes.
Never mentioned that he forgot his birthday.
Huh. Now,
who owned the house?
Yeah, and I had Robert Parry on my program right after this, and he talked about...
Who owned the house?
Yes. About this house.
It wasn't in Joe's. It was in a what was it? The name of the street. It was owned by a franchise or a group or something. It wasn't Joe's house.
Okay.
Who rang the fire brigade?
That I don't know. I don't remember.
Again, it's Brian Hutchinson tells you the thing that Joe Biles always has at least two mobile phones in his pocket. Why didn't he ring the fire brigade as soon as he got out of the house? Why was it left to a passerby?
Ah, okay.
No, Brian Hutchinson again tells us that Ari did all his work from the house. You know, he's particularly worried about being attacked by George Bush and the CIA. Or Mossad. There was no security at the house. Have a look at the house. There was no security. There's no big fences or or you know, fences designed to keep people out. There's no shutters on the windows. There was no security. It was an ordinary residential house.
Okay.
Tell me, when any Israeli intelligence officer retires, where does he go to live?
Israel.
What the bloody hell was Ari Ben Menashe doing living in Montreal then?
Yes, exactly.
In a very Jewish community. If he wants to be attacked by Mossad, why is he living in a very, very predominant Jewish community?
Okay.
Ari Ben Menashe, the whole story of Ari Ben Menashe is a pure, it's cover designed to keep the average person away from him and to let him go. No, you read of all these terrible things that Dickens and Madsen did, duping different African countries, you know, with wheat sales and things like that, grabbing the deposit and running.
Right.
And then Brian Hutchinson tells you every time Ari Ben Menashe comes into town, he's immediately put into a little limousine and driven up to a hotel somewhere where he can be interviewed by the Foreign Office.
Huh.
I beg your pardon? How do you know? It sounds beautiful. Read it. Then scratch your head and says, who tells you that? Who has informed Brian Hutchinson of this? Don't tell me the Canadian government would be that open about it. Now, let me see if I can find that other article. No, I haven't got that one. Hang on a minute. I'm going to have to find another article in a minute.
Okay.
You'll love this one. You're in Texas, aren't you?
No. I'm in the Chicago suburbs.
Chicago, right. All right, my documents, miscellaneous. A protected species. I want the protected species. I don't want Jim violence. I don't want the mouse. What I want a protected species. Thank you. Right, now this, you know what Hansard is?
What is?
Hansard.
No.
Hansard is every word that is spoken in Parliament in a British Commonwealth is taken down by Hansard.
Okay.
Right, now this is from the Canadian Hansard on Thursday, the 21st of March, 2002. And it comes from Mr. Keith Martin. He's got a horrible S-squim out, or Jean de Frisier, the Canadian Alliance. He's speaking. Mr. Speaker, the actions of Ari Ben Menashe and his Canadian company, Dickens and Madsen, have put the life of Zimbabwe opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai in extreme danger. Mr. Tsvangirai has been charged with treason, which calls for the death penalty, based on a highly questionable videotape done by the same individuals. These individuals have been involved in a history of fraud and extortion around the world. Will the Solicitor General instruct the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to investigate the international activities of Ari Ben Menashe, Alex Legault, and their company Dickens and Madsen? The reply, the Honourable Lawrence Macaulay, the Solicitor General of Canada. Mr. Speaker, I understand that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police is investigating the allegations. As my Honourable colleague is well aware, I am certainly not in a position to indicate whether it should or should not, but the Royal Canadian Mounted Police is indicating that it is investigating. So instead of investigating Dickens and Madsen, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police closed their case on the 10th of July for lack of evidence that Mr. Tsvangirai plotted in Canada to eliminate Mr. Mugabe. Somebody moved the goalpost. Do you understand?
Right. So they were going to assassinate him and then...
No. It was a setup.
Okay.
All they had to do was get in, ask a few certain questions, and Morgan, Tsvangirai, sort of thing, could be charged with treason, and removed. And you know, That was a British. That was a British psyops to continue to let Robert Mugabe rule and destroy Zimbabwe.
All right. Okay. So what the claim that you have made is that you have said that Jim Stone is Joe Biles.
Yes.
And what do you base that claim on?
Well, the first thing was that, again, Ari Benbanashi resurfaced, you know, on that house fire in Montreal on the 3rd, 4th of December last year.
Right.
That what that simply means is he's now back in operation.
Okay.
And we've got that. But Jim Stone made a early in his piece, referred back to an article written by Joe Biles called Danger Mind Controllers at Work. It was one of the most ludicrous articles ever written by Joe Biles. And if Jim Stone had any intelligence whatsoever, he would never have used it.
I wonder why he did.
Because he's Joe Biles, and Joe Biles is an egotist.
Okay.
If you go into the if you go into the article of that Joe Biles wrote on the 15th of May 2005, Danger Mind Controllers at Work, he refers back to a thing called a tracheoscope. The tachyoscope sort of thing, Joe Biles says, supposedly works at about 1/50th of a second, and was used in films or in theatre and that to pass subliminal messages to the viewer.
Okay.
And it's complete hogwash. Now, the tachyoscope was invented by the United States, I think it was the Air Force. Let's see if I can find it.
Yeah, I've got this article up here. It was written on, copyrighted by Joe Biles, 15th of May, 2005. Okay.
Right, you got the picture of the tracheoscope a quarter of the way down?
Yes. Yes.
Right, this is what I've written. The tracheoscope is a device for flashing up a series of images at great speed. Although originally designed by the U.S. Air Force to help train pilots to recognize enemy aircraft, tracheoscopes were used in early attempts to train people to speed read. Because the images or text always appear at the same place, the viewer's eyes do not have to move to read the next word, thus greatly reducing the amount of time wasted while eyes refocus. Following the tracheoscope's discovery, Harvard University Business School introduced the first film aid course designed to widen the reader's field of focus in order to increase reading speed. Again, the focus was on visual processing as a means of improvement. Using the machine to increase the people's reading speed was a trend in the 1940s. While it was clearly established that reading speed increase of 100% were possible and had been attained, lasting results were yet to be determined or demonstrated. The speed of the tachyoscope could go up to 1/500th of a second. Joe Biles, in his article, I think you'll find, says it's 1/50th of a second. And the whole thing, in many ways, Joe's article was totally absurd. We've just had another election, federal election in Australia, and a gentleman, a billionaire from Queensland, Clive Palmer, has just won 5 seats. Clive Palmer was able to get onto television with paid advertisements and advertisements or the newspaper. He wiped out one of the best up and coming political parties in Queensland on his effort. He's done that simply by using the television, because everybody today, you know, if you see it on television, it must be true.
Sure.
50 years ago, everybody read a book, and if it was in the book, it must be true.
Well, that is the way that people think.
Yes. So all you have to do then is to use or abuse that. And
okay.
So, but this article of mind of danger mind control is a work. It's never been. You know, it starts off. So you think you voted for George Bush or Tony Blair or John Howard on their merits? Think again. Media mind control techniques have now reached a new standard of excellence in the West. Out go old-fashioned baseball caps and heavy drugs, replaced by low-light images, a new color-coded language fired straight down your unsuspecting optic nerve. Now, there's a big problem with that. If you're going to receive a coded language, how do you decipher it?
Exactly. Yes.
So, you know, throw in some, when I was in the Army Reserve, we used to call them Group 16 words, put in a few things, and, you know, people can immediately be fascinated and think, well, and not even stop to think, you know, of exactly what they're reading. And Jim Stone is using the exact same techniques. Right, so...
Okay, so you're basing it on circumstantial evidence.
It's always been circumstantial. There is no actual, we'll say, physical evidence yet that anyone could get... You'd never know. Where's the article from the... I've done from the book Open Verdict. It's marvelous. You can read things 15 years later, and you know things can hit you like a bomb. I don't want to. I want the Open Verdict. This is what Tony Collins has written about Joe Vile, and it's on page 224 of the book Open Verdict.
Okay.
Joe believes that psychology has reached the age or the stage where it is every bit as much of a science as acoustics or metallurgy. It is possible, he says, for the subconscious to be clandestinely influenced to such a degree that people can be tricked into killing themselves. Good heavens above, they've been using that every time something to get people to enlist to fight wars. Such a system, he asserts, provides the perfect solution for a democracy wanting to remove a small number of people who are predisposed to endanger national security. The system is inherently safe because the public would be unable to comprehend that it is possible.
Okay, and
now if you've got my article on the mouse that roared, that's on page 20.
Right.
Read it for yourself. Understand exactly what Joe is telling us there. And it was written in, the book came out in about 1990. The perfect solution for a democracy to remove or murder a number of people who are predisposed to endanger national security. The system is inherently safe because the public would be unable to comprehend that it was possible.
Right. And then you ask the question, which democracy was it that wanted to remove Michael Hastings? What threat was Michael Hastings to national security? Does this murderous system continue to be inherently safe?
Yes, it's a lovely. That's a lovely question. Jim Stone has been directing people away from it. I'm trying to push them back towards it.
Okay. So you're saying that he's a gatekeeper, that he is attempting to avert people, divert them from learning and knowing about certain things. He's pointing them in another direction. Is that what?
Yes.
Okay.
And confusing them.
Is that standard operating procedure?
Standard operating procedures. It has been for, 200 years, 500 years? Webster Tarpley, in his books, refers back to the gunpowder plot of 1608 with James I, or James VI of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And again, divert the people's attention away, have somebody take out the main bloke who knew exactly what was going on. The bloke who was set up, was that Percy or was it Guy Fawkes? I can't remember. Webster Tarpley, lovely man once you start understanding what he's writing about.
I think he's kind of a gatekeeper too, in my opinion.
Could be. Why he's still going, but definitely... Jim Stone has done that. Now, another article that of Joe Viles that Jim Stone used was his thing about using the nuclear bomb for both Arche and Bali.
Okay.
I think the main one I think that Jim Stone used was the Arche earthquake and tsunami. And
okay.
And Joe Viles says that they used a mini nuke. Now, where if they used a nuclear device, where did they get it from?
Well, there would only be a couple of places that they could acquire that, the United States and Israel.
Well, forget about Israel. It would have to come to too many places and too many people would be involved.
Okay.
And not one of them is Israeli. Please remember with the Archer, it's Australia was the Americans' deputy dog. We were doing most of the work. What? It occurred on the 26th of December, was it 2004? Doesn't matter. There's one I think it was on. There was two terrorist attacks that the Australian Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, warned us about. First one, I think, was in early December 2003. He warned all Australians of travelling overseas.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, to be take care of possible terrorist attack. The actual terrorist attack occurred on the 26th of December 2003 at a place in Iran called Bam, B-A-M, and it was a major earthquake.
Really?
Yes. In December 2004, the Australian Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, warned all of Australians travelling overseas that possible terrorist attack could be involving a Hilton hotel. On the 26th of December, we had the Arches earthquake and tsunami.
Right.
On the 27th of December 2004, on the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, during the break of the Ashes test at Melbourne, the ABC interviewed a spokesperson from FEMA who said that they had been monitoring the situation at Arche but were unable to warn anyone of the effects except the EMA, the Emergency Management Australia.
Yeah, isn't it amazing that they monitor all of these events and they have records of it? For instance, the tsunami in 2005 in Indonesia, The people, the Americans who have a base on Diego Garcia, which is in the Indian Ocean, knew exactly. They tracked the storm, they knew it was coming, and yet they didn't issue any warnings at all to those people.
The spokesman from FIFA told the ABC they didn't have enough time to issue warnings to other countries. Now, they only had 4 hours and 28 minutes to warn Sri Lanka. That's the time it took for the tsunami to travel from Aceh to strike Sri Lanka. And again, if you then ask why, and I think I mentioned in that article I've written about Harry Mason and Bright Skies, the testing that was going on in outback Western Australia from 1989 till 1996, where they were testing electromagnetic scalar weapons systems. Japan was there, and there was Japan, there was Australia, there was the French were there. I don't know who was, but definitely Joe Biles was there. Now, if you take Joe Biles with his work as an open verdict, where the problems are bringing on these electronic warfare systems, and you then bring it over to Western Australia where they're going for the electromagnetic scalar weapons, it's a continuation of the same field. And that's why Joe Biles was over in Perth from 1989 until he died in 2005, supposedly. That was his main reason for being there. But Joe Biles was also a he also used to go around assassinating people.
Do you have any names of the people that he has assassinated?
The book. Hang on a minute. I'll have to put the light on as well. Hang on.
Now, this article that that Andrew has written, Jim Stone actually responded to it, and he said this like 3 days ago, that this is incredibly stupid and no doubt the result of my posting of the letter to the Jewish man where I told of my experience at Beth Hamidrash and Sherry Tefila Synagogue. Since the Jewish community has no way to rebut what I posted about them, they have to resort to slander such as this. This is lame. Now, I'm not sure that Andrew has any affiliation with the Jewish community that Jim is referring to, so I'm just really not certain. This isn't an interesting article that Andrew has written, and it was published at The Rebel. And he goes into a lot of he talks about this whistleblower paperback written by Dr. Shiv Chopra. But anyway, there's a lot of details here, a lot of interesting details. Are you back, Andrew?
Yes, I'm back.
So I read the response that Jim Stone made to this article. Now, do you have any affiliation with the Jewish community that he is referring to?
Good heavens above. I'm based in Geelong, in Victoria, in Australia, the arsehole of the world, as our soldiers just said in the Second World War. I've got no affiliation with anybody. I know a couple of Jews. I don't normally associate with Jews. I'm not very religious. And I've been writing these type of things since 1998.
Right.
So, there's all my work. Most of it's on the Port Arthur massacre. And what I find extremely interesting is every time a PSYOP stuffs up, the Port Arthur massacre. Once we started speaking about it, Joe Biles immediately said, oh, it was a Mossad-run operation. And I eventually came out with an article when I said Joe Biles was right. You know, Joe Biles was running it. He didn't know whether it was a Mossad-run operation or not. You have a look at 9/11. It was a Mossad-run operation. So I guess Mossad then tells the American President Bush and Vice President Cheney and everyone else what to do and how to do it.
Well, I think it was a collaboration between the U.S. government and the Mossad and the CIA.
Yes. You then have a look at the... Well, in actual fact, who would? It's, what was it, Silverstein, Frank Lowry, who would they bring in to do the work they required to bring the towers down? They wouldn't bring in an American company, would they?
No.
No, thank you. So, yes, they'd have to use somebody very much like somebody within Mossad to do the dirty work for them. And that's why the five dancing Israelis, once they were deported back to Israel, one of them got on television and said, "We were there to film the event."
Sure.
So, Mossad was involved. The same with the London bombing in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was 7th of July, 2005.
Right.
And Nick Holderstrom's done a fantastic job on that. You know, he was trained, he was university, he was a university lecturer. He's incredibly competent in his thinking style and in his research. Lovely man. You've got Benjamin Netanyahu there. You know, he supposedly was born prior to Scotland Yard warned me not to leave the hotel. Scotland Yard said, "No way, we didn't know." Then he says, "Oh, you know, it came via Scotland Yard warned the Mossad embassy and the whatever." When you realise that the first explosives that went off, they were reported as being electrical surges. They weren't bombs. So Netanyahu being there sort of thing, he was well and truly aware. But the London bombing, you know, the BBC did a program on it a year before it went off.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, well, you know, it could only have been done by MI5. But where does MI5 hire people to plant bombs in the British underground?
Well, I think...
You'd use a foreign company, you know, somebody with from Israel, and that's how come both Ephraim Halevi and Benjamin Netanyahu were aware of what was going on. The people who placed the bombs were Israelis. The people that murdered the so-called Muslim terror bombers, and they were. Three of them were murdered at the Canary Wharf, and the fourth one, the Sid Khan, he was bumped off of, you know, as soon as he went to say, "Look, I can't make the exercise, you know, 2 days ahead." So then my wife is going to hospital. She's miscarried. I've got to stay home with the wife. So he never got home. And then you've got the Brazilian the men in there who was so bumped off by the so-called police, anti-terror squad, and they shot what, 7, 8, 9 times. So one bloke held him, the other bloke went up with a Glock, went bang, 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 bang. Totally illegal in the UK. Any policeman who grabs a bloke, he's now under arrest, and then murders him. You know, he's up for murder. It wasn't done by the British forces. It was done by by the same people who put the bombs in. And, you know, Nick Holderstrom will tell you a little bit about that as well. So, again, if you have a look at that, I've written a couple of articles there where you can debunk what the police actually tell you.
Right. And of course, the official version of every story is totally wrong, and they tell you what they want us to believe. And even if you look at the CIA, part of their job description includes demolition and bombing and all kinds of things, and they usually perpetrate those kinds of acts in other country. So it's reasonable to assume that that the U.S. government would hire foreigners to do the same kinds of things that the CIA does, but that they are not allowed to do in this country. Does that make sense or no?
Yes. Well, they've got to cover their asses.
Yes.
It's as simple as that. And look, the real interesting thing with Jim Stone is that most of his work now is getting put out by the Rebel in Oz in Australia. And he's doing most of his homework in Canada and America. So why would it only be printed in Australia?
I've always found, I've interviewed Jim Stone. This has been about a year and a half ago. And his work has a spectacular quality about it. He makes a lot of claims that I'm not sure that he is able to prove, which it kind of makes you skeptical.
Well, the number one question is, where does he get his information from?
Exactly.
How does he know?
Exactly. And
you know, Joe Biles in that article of Danger Mind Controllers at Work, you know, he makes claims, you know, that this is above top secret. If it's above
then
top
how does
secret,
he know?
For heaven's sake, how does he know?
Yes.
I mean, he can't know if it's above top secret. Unless, of course, he wrote it.
Yes. Yes, he does seem to.
So it's exactly the same thing with Jim Stone. And the actual, you know, once this article has come out, Andrew Winkler on the Rebel site put it out, all the attacks that come from me have virtually come from Western Australia. James Fagani is from Western Australia. One of his commentators, Peter Bridge, is from Western Australia. And you start having a look at, why is it in Western Australia?
Now, you mentioned...
Because Joe Biles worked there.
James Fargani.
That was where Joe Biles was based from 1989 until 2005, when he supposedly died, and he then moved over to Canada, becoming Ari Ben Menashe. And again, our poor old intelligence services, and that's a ludicrous name for them because most of them aren't that intelligent. But you know, they make up a story and oh dear, sorry, we've got to change it. And so they, you know, you have a look at the story of Ari Ben Menashe in Canada, you know, 2002. Both Ari Ben Menashe and Alexander Henry Legault are getting divorced from their wives. They've got free Canada. They can't come back. Mrs. Francis Legault is getting all the property and the billions of money made by these two scoundrels. Right, and then stuff me dead. 2 years later, Ari Ben Menashe has gone to court and he's beaten the charges of assault against him, you know, for assaulting his ex-wife and his ex-mother-in-law. There's talks about, started off with their, you know, they had a five-year-old child sort of thing and, you know, they were, the wife and mother-in-law then fled Canada and went over to New York State, but they were forced to come back to give evidence in the court. And you think, now, hang on, Canada's one country, New York State's another country.
Right.
But for a court or the police to get somebody to travel from New York State back to Canada to give evidence, you need an extradition warrant.
Sure you do.
They have to be charged, they have to go to before a court. It didn't happen. It hasn't happened. Ergo, the whole story is is a fraud. It's fake. You finally, Brian Hutchinson, I think in 2003, wrote that finally the Canadian government has decided it wants nothing more to do with Ari Bambanashi. So thing that they're sick and tired of him being such a naughty boy. No, the operation's finished. They don't need him anymore. He's never been charged for his frauds or his deceptions or his any form of dishonesty. Brian Hutchins tells you he's never been to court, except for the one where he is charged for assault with his ex, for his wife, ex-wife. I mean, if the company, Carrington Sales or whatever, defrauded, say, Kenya of $14 million, what would the Kenyans do? Immediately issue warrants and that, you know, for the company in Montreal, wouldn't they? They'd immediately issue them, take them to court and get their money back. It never happened. So you have a look at all, it's all a story. It's all a thing to cover, to give these blokes some background, so, you know, everybody thinks they know who they are, but they know nothing, because it's all lies. It's all deceit. Now, you asked me before about the people that Joe Biles murdered.
Right.
If you have a look at the book Open Verdict, and the people who suicided by jumping off bridges or suicided by tying a car tow rope around their neck, one end around their neck, the other end around a tree, and then driving off. You got Vimal Bangvagi. You've got an Indian. He died on the Monday, the 4th of April, 1986. You've got Ashad Sharif, who died on the Monday, Tuesday, the 28th of October, 1986. The third bloke, Atar Singh Gitta, he didn't die. He suddenly realised that people were getting bumped off, so he vanished. And they ended up finding him working in the red light district in Paris a year after the event. And he didn't, for some unknown reason, he didn't want to go back to England. So then you go back to Robert McLean Wilson of 1972-73. You've got, I'm not too sure about Gerald Jack Darson. You've got Trevor Knight on Friday the 25th of the 3rd, 1988. Alistair Beckham, August 1988. Brigadier Peter Ferry, he was the last on September 1988. David Sands on Monday the 30th of March 1987. And, you know, you have a look at all these people. You get a bloke who's just changed jobs, so he commits suicide. He's going to get an extra £2,000 per annum, so he commits suicide. I like that one.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Robert McLean Wilson, who just about ready to retire. So he goes up to his attic one day and he finds all these documents, you know, marked top secret in his attic. Oh, shit, I better take them back to work. So he takes them back to work. And 2 days later, he then shoots himself in the chest.
Wow.
But survives. And then a year later, he then goes out and kills himself with carbon monoxide poisoning by working in the garage with the door closed.
Right. Now, when we first started the interview, you said that, 25 scientists, 25 people had been suicided or...
Well, these are the names, some of the names I've been reading out here.
Okay.
So, and you have there's a couple of them I'm not certain about. You've got a couple of sexual deviants. One of them was Mark Wisner. You know, he may have actually accidentally killed himself by doing things. Or again, he could be murdered, but there's car crashes, there's carbon dioxide poisoning, there's a couple of blokes jumping or falling off bridges. Yeah, so, and then there's the girl, Shani Warren, who tied herself up with ropes, then walked out into 18 inches of waters and drowned herself. One of the blokes, Dennis Skinner, who died in June 1985 in Moscow, and he was a spy, and I'd say he got bumped off by some other person. But the book Open Verdict, once you start reading it, you take the opposite view of what the authors are trying to tell you. It becomes extremely interesting.
Sure. So basically, the thing that you notice about Jim Stone is that he seems to have all this extremely private information that he divulges, and then he often says, well, for instance, he fled to Mexico, or he fled here, or fled there. And I'm thinking, how could this guy get into so much trouble and keep producing these articles where he seems to have such private information that nobody else has? And I think, I don't know, he just seems to play
too good
the victim.
To be true. If the other thing, when was it Anthony Snowden?
Uh-huh.
First came out, Jim Stone did an article on him and said, you know, when I worked in the NSA.
Yes.
Well, can I state this quite emphatically? Once you work for the NSA, you never stop working for them.
Exactly. It's like being in the mafia. Once you're in the mafia, you don't just say, oh, I'm retiring. I mean, you're always in the mafia, just like you're always in the CIA.
Yes. Or in Asia, or ASIS, or MI5, or MI6. You're always there. There's always context. And if they need you for something, yes. And they never advertise. They never say, trust me, I'm from the CIA.
Right.
And one of the real interesting things, you know the Boston bombing?
Sure.
You know a little bit about
that,
don't you?
Sure, absolutely.
Right, you understand it. Are you aware of the two FBI agents who suddenly fell out of a helicopter and died a couple of weeks after that event?
No, I didn't know that.
I'll find the article and I'll send it to you.
Okay.
So you've got a couple of honest blokes who working for the country in the FBI, and they suddenly realise that things aren't good. Or they objected to certain criminal behaviors. What happens to them? They fall out of a helicopter.
Right. And some of the people that were in charge of disposing of Osama bin Laden's body in the ocean also met with tragic ends, which kind of makes you...
You mean the
SEAL
that's
team.
That's not just the SEAL team.
Right, the SEAL team.
The other thing, Jim Stone's now on the run. Now, what was Ari Benbenassi doing back in 1990? Why did Ari Benbenassi head to Australia?
Probably he was
on the run. Remember? He was on the run.
Yes.
And if you remember, Robert Parry wrote a thing about him in 1990.
Sure.
I'll send you another article on that. And yet, once you understand, you know it's all
staged.
Cocky. It's all cow droppings, whatever you
yes,
like to call
it. Yes, it's all staged.
Yeah. So, but, Robert Parry says that, one of his friends in the intelligence told him, or one of them sort of thing, that when Ari Benbenassi comes back, he's getting on a flight and he's going to land in America, such and such, son. We've got the warrant for it. We've got him, son. So Robert Parry then rings up Ari Benbenassi and says, don't get on the plane, son. They're waiting for you.
Yes, it's all very interesting how these people work together and seem to know what's going on. And yes.
But look, when do police ever, you know, ring up or tell criminals or think that they're going to come out, you know, we've got an arrest warrant somewhere coming out after you?
Right, they don't do that.
They never do it. Nope. For heaven's sake.
No, nope, they never
they
do
that. They keep
their
mouth shut. The one thing I used to, the one trick I was told about what they used to do many back in the 60s, is that they're going out to make an arrest warrant. They used to ring up the solicitor who represented the crim, because the crims normally would have a paid solicitor on standby. They'd ring him up, and when he'd answer the phone, they'd immediately put the, they wouldn't hang up on him, and they'd just put the phone down beside it so that the line to the solicitor's
was occupied.
Pub or wherever, was now tied up. It couldn't be used. The criminal couldn't ring him. And the solicitor would have to go outside to find another telephone to make any calls to. And the police would then go out to the crim that they had the arrest warrant for, arrest him and take him back to a police station, not their office, and do the interview there. So that the solicitor didn't know which one of his clients they were going for, and which police station they'd have him at.
It's kind of a tricky trick.
Oh, look, believe me, anyone who knows police will know that, you know, as one of my associates once said to me, there are a lot of blokes who should be in jail, except for the fact that they were wearing a blue uniform.
Right.
That, again, hasn't changed, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, what's the old saying? It takes a thief to catch a thief.
Sure.
Yeah. But the whole thing on, you know, on what I've got on Ari Benbenashi, what I've got on Joe Viles, what I've got on Dr. Keith Allen Noble and Jim Stone, it's all circumstantial.
Okay.
It is circumstantial.
Okay.
But you can still be convicted on circumstantial evidence. And the one thing people should be doing when they start reading articles is that, you know, where did this information come from? You know, how was it obtained? Where is there any corroboration? And when you have a look at Jim Stone writing about Fukushima, as soon as that incident occurred, people were going on about HAARP and how HAARP had been, they could actually demonstrate that HAARP had been initiated. And then Jim Stone comes in and says, oh no, it was Mossad, it was nuclear bombs and all this stuff, which in actual fact cannot be corroborated. You can't prove it. But it's totally removed the thing of HAARP. So that becomes interesting. But you really have a look, you know, at the mini nukes. What's a mini nuke? You know, he said that the Israelis, you know, planted bombs, you know, to blow up the Fukushima nuclear power plant. Well,
he said they also had some sort of program on the computers there, and that they did it via the computers. And he talks about, well, and he says 3/11 was Japan's 9/11. It's all documented, folks. But then he really doesn't go on to document it.
No, Joe Viles always used to refer to his scientific evidence. He could never produce it. There was never any. They just keep on, you know, wait, I've got this evidence, you know, I can prove it. But in actual fact, that, you know, they can't. It never occurs. But if you consider HAARP, and that becomes an electric scale of weapons systems attack, that creates the tsunami.
Right.
It can also be used to create an actual attack on the power plant.
Absolutely. An earthquake of any kind. If
you consider the Bali bombing, and I always consider the Bali bombing, I believe the Indonesians, they said it was the bomb of C4. You know, it 10-foot hole in the ground, what, a metre deep, on a bitumen road, and it totally destroyed concrete buildings in Kuta. The Australians are now convinced it was only one bomb, but in actual fact there were three. There was the bomb at the Paddy's Bar, at the Sari Club, and somebody also threw a bomb with human excreta, at the American consul at Kuta. So you know it's a setup. You know the government's lying. You know the Australian Federal Police were so good. They went over there into a foreign country, took over, and they actually were able to find the ignition system or whatever it was, the system that set off the bomb. You know, they created this 1 meter hole or deep hole, 10 foot wide, in the ground outside the Sari Club, and destroyed concrete buildings. They actually found the system that was used to detonate the bomb. They actually found parts of a mobile phone that was the weapon, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And you know the bastards are lying.
Sure.
That was Kilty, Mick Kilty led his team over there. So.
Well, it's an interesting article that you've done. I'm glad that the Rebel featured it, that they published it, and it's also interesting the rebuttal that you did to James Fairgain, and. I mean, you've asked some good questions here, and certainly it makes us think, because we really don't. Well, James Fairgain, I don't know how to pronounce his name, said that he knows Jim Stone, that Jim Stone is a good family man, and that he knows him. He knows his real name. He spent dozens of hours talking with him on Skype. After he...
That's a beauty. Let's stick with this. Jim Stone's on the run in Mexico. Mm-hmm. You've got the CIA, the NSA, you've got all the police forces all after him. They've all got the latest detection devices. Now, Jim Stone's not Hamas,
no.
Is he? All right? What do the... How long does it take for the Mossad or Shin Bet, whatever it is over in Israel, to track down Hamas leader and take him out? All he has to do is one 30-second telephone call and they've got him.
Yes, especially if you...
And here's Jim Stone talking to James Fagani on Skype.
They would find him immediately.
For hours of him.
Through the IP address.
Good heavens above. Please don't treat us as bloody children.
Yes. All righty. Well, Andrew, I hope that people will read your article and evaluate this with their own, just draw their own conclusions after reading the article.
Look, the thing is, I am positive that Jim Stone was originally Joe Viles.
Wow.
It's carrying on the same thing. But there's always a possibility that I may be wrong. It's just somebody who uses exactly the same persona, exactly the same storyline, and has been trained in exactly the same way as Joe Viles has been trained. But the end thing that makes no difference is they're both running the same game. They are both spooks. They are both giving out disinformation, and they're both deceiving the people of the world while they go about with their murderous intent. And again, if you compare, what's in the book Open Verdict by Tony Collins with the deaths of David Sands on the 30th of March 1987 and with what Joe Viles says happened to him, You've got virtually the same type of bomb going off. Now, Mercedes-Benz don't burst into flames. Mercedes-Benz, the motors don't fall out and fly 200 yards up the road from them. So you definitely know that Michael Hastings was murdered. You don't know by who, but the person said, you know, look at this. Be very careful of him. The possibility that Michael Hastings was bumped off by Jim Stone is extremely high.
Wow. Well, that's quite a statement. That's quite a claim.
I'm not saying it's absolute, but it is extremely high.
Okay. Right. Like I say, people need to read the book that you've mentioned, which Open Verdict by David Sands.
By Tony Collins.
By Tony Collins.
And you should be able to find it on Amazon. There's a few books over, both in England and in America for sale. They're all secondhand books. But they are extremely interesting in the information that they give you.
Right, and I always believe that people need to read outside of what they read on the internet, that they need to corroborate what they are posting on the internet, what they're reading on the internet, with outside information, and there are, you know, millions of books available that would corroborate some of the things that you've said, or at least give people pause to say, well, Andrew has really got something there. I need to investigate this further.
But again, when you're reading these books, understand something. They're telling you what they want you to believe.
Everybody writes with a bias, absolutely.
So you've got to actually read what they're telling you and then come up and say, you know, just exactly what is going on. And when in the prologue of the book written by Stephen Oskell, he talks about this new war. Well, there's no new war. And he talks about, people dying in war, scientists and computer programmers and people like this. Well, they're not dying in war. They're being, if they're being killed, they're not dying in war. They're being murdered. And that is really what you've got to understand. Any undeclared war is in reality not a war.
Right. Well, just like the Rebel of Oz said, the author of this article, Andrew McGregor, is a retired Australian police officer from the state of Victoria. Andrew McGregor's work on the Port Arthur and Sandy Hook massacres is second to none. If Andrew McGregor accuses a highly regarded fellow activists like Jim Stone of being an infiltrator, we must pay attention and verify it. So that's what people can do. They can read your article. They can read some of the books that you've mentioned. They can evaluate it for themselves. They can evaluate some of Jim Stone's articles and just draw their own conclusions. And that's what we all have to do with things that we hear and read.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew. I really appreciate you being on the program today. All right. Have a great day, okay?
Good morning.
Yes, a great day. And I will have a good evening. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, dear. Bye.